We've been talking this weekend about some of the serious challenges that the people of God face and how we can defend against them, how God has provided everything we need to be equipped against the serious challenges that we face in 2022. And today we're going to be talking about defending against loneliness. It might be easy in our minds to confine loneliness to a few people in a few isolated times. Have you ever wondered what loneliness really looks like if you had to depict it? Like if I were to ask you to draw a picture of what loneliness looked like, do you know what you would draw? I love it because the internet gives us exactly what we need in the moment. Because this week I thought, what would be a good image of loneliness? And here came the internet. I like this picture of this guy who was all by himself. Are you hearing the song in your head? All by myself and no one who was there. I've seen this one circulate a lot with SpongeBob eating all by himself, having dinner, and there's no one there by his side. What's fascinating is that this meme has sparked all sorts of different pictures of the strangest eating places that exist. I'm going to show it to you. There's almost some eating places that exist to highlight the fact that you're by yourself. Like, who designed this seat? It's almost as if to say, you're a party of one, and you're going to stay as a party of one. Or look at the scenery of this one. Oh, he's got the view, doesn't he? I think my favorite one, this happened a few years ago. The Lakers were heading to the bench after a play. He's up for a high five. Oh, when you have to give yourself a high five, that is like the pinnacle of loneliness. I don't know his name, but if we can send some cards and some prayers, he's going to need it. That's just... Now, here's the thing. As much as we smile and we laugh, because there's something really relatable about that. We've all been alone. We know those feelings. There's something really surprising, and I think we need to start here, that there is a growing number of young people who are experiencing feelings, high feelings of isolation and loneliness. Generation Z, however early you want to put that, as early 2000s, and we'll say 2010s, whatever it is, our youngest kids are feeling lonelier than ever before. 79% have experienced at one time or another in their life that they feel lonely. And while there's a lot of science behind this, reasons that could contribute to this, one of the highest finding contributors to loneliness today is the fact that our kids have smartphones. The teens around the world are lonelier than they were before than a decade ago, and all these different statistics and findings are attributing them to continual access to smart devices. It is the irony that in an age in which we are connected more than ever before, we're actually lonelier than ever before. That even though we have social media, we are far less social beings than we have been. I want to put a few things on the screen. I know it's going to be a lot of words. I'm going to go through it. You don't have to feel the need to read it. I just want to explain a few things that will maybe highlight where we are and why this matters. In 36 out of 37 countries, feelings of loneliness among teens rose sharply between 2012 and 2018, and that was the year that the smartphone ownership rose over 50%. It says that if a teen's friends use social media, they're going to be less available for in-person interaction. In other words, as you'll see at the top and the bottom of the screen, teens would much rather connect and be engaged electronically than in person today. During in-person interaction, there's something called fubbing. I think I said that correctly, which is when a teen is together and they're hanging out, but while they're together, the phone goes off and they go and they check their phone and there's an emotional drop in that moment because they are not giving their time and attention to their friend they are with. School administrations, principals, teachers are all admitting the same fact that in middle schools and high schools, there is an eerie sense of silence in the lunchroom and the hallways because teens are not talking to one another. They are simply on their phones. In fact, in 1970, some of you were around back then, 1970s, 52% of 12th graders got with their friends almost every day, but that's only about 28% in 2017. Phones are distracting from real social life. In fact, one study says that phones are hurting us in two ways. One is that they're keeping teens from getting together, but then the phones and social media are reminding teens who are home that they're not being involved in all the things that teens are posting in. That is, you're left out of all the interactions and fun. It's called FOMO, the fear of missing out, that I'm not involved with everything else that is happening in my friends' lives. And in fact, as you see at the bottom of the screen, we need to catch our attention. It's a high percentage of millennials and Gen Zs that would just much rather spend time online and connect online than to be in person. And this has been around for a while now. 2012 is when that started spiking. Teens are feeling less social. They're feeling lonely. And then you add on top of all of that mountain on the screen, a worldwide pandemic And it just made things a lot worse. That 36% since 2020 have reported to feeling lonely all the time. 61% of ages 18 to 25 said they have high feelings of loneliness, and that's associated with anxiety and depression and discouragement. And many of these young people will report statements such as, I feel like no one really cares, genuinely cares about me, that no one was really listening. Now, loneliness and isolation are not the same things, because you can be in a group of people, you can be on a pew filled with people and still feel completely alone and by yourself. Loneliness is not just isolated to our young people. In fact, I think every one of us experiences at one time or another. But if we're looking at our church family today, there are some people who have a higher propensity for loneliness than others. Our older members, especially our widows and widowers, and our single members are some who hit the high part of that list. They just really feel like no one is really paying attention to me. No one listens to me. No one knows that I'm here. No one knows what it is that I am going through. And so in 1 Kings chapter 19, what I like about this passage is that we see a prophet of God who knew exactly what this was like. In 1 Kings chapter 18, the prophet Elijah was standing on Mount Carmel. He was bold, he was brave, he was courageous, and he stood against the prophets of Baal and proved once for all for the people of God that there's only one God, and that's Jehovah God. That's a moment of triumph. But then 1 Kings 19 begins in verse 1 when it says that Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a message to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as one of the life of them by tomorrow about this time." And he was afraid, and he arose, and he ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. Instead of standing up, being bold against this queen, he ran and he fled. There's an important lesson here. I think it's right off the page, and God wants us to see it, and that is there are times when our victories make us vulnerable, that the times in which we really believe we're strong and invincible are the times we may be blind to serious weaknesses in our lives. Chapter 18 and chapter 19 are paired together to remind us that there's really a short distance between a mountain of victory and a cave of shame and defeat. Because here's Elijah, and in one moment, he's standing tall and standing firm for the cause of God. And here in chapter 19, he doesn't consult the Lord. He doesn't get counsel from God. He's so consumed with the words of a wicked woman, they completely cripple him, and he runs. And he runs the opposite way. And he runs and distances himself from any source or form of encouragement or help. In the end of verse 3, he leaves his servant and he flees. Verse 4, he went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. He requested for himself that he might die and said, "It's enough now, O Lord. Take my life, for I'm not better than my father's." In verse 8, he leaves from there and he travels 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. He came there in verse 9 to a cave, and he lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Elijah says in verse 10, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. They seek my life to take it away." Well, the Lord comes to Elijah while he's on the mountain. The Lord says, "I want you to stand on the mountain and I will come to you." And a lot of things come by. There's a great wind, there's an earthquake, there's a fire, and God's not in any of those. But this gentle breeze comes and the Lord speaks to Elijah and he asks the same question in verse 13. When Elijah heard this gentle blowing, he wrapped his face in the mantle and he went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. And they seek my life to take it away." Here's Elijah, completely distanced himself from any source of help or encouragement or support. Isn't it a strange irony that in the times that we need encouragement and fellowship and support the most are the times that we most feel like being by ourselves and being isolated and withdrawing? There's Elijah, and he believes two times. Two times he says it, one in verse 10 and one in verse 14, "I am alone. There's no one else. No one else but me. No one else standing up faithful for the Lord but me. Have you felt that before? I am the only one. I am all alone at school, and there is no one, no one who cares about God, no one who is faithful to Jesus, no one who reads their Bible, no one who has right, upstanding, godly morals. I'm the only one at work. I'm the only one at school. I'm the only one on the team. I'm the only one in the club. I'm the only one at church who's really interested in the spiritual things. It's defeating. It's deflating. It's weakening to feel like there's no one but you on the side of what is right. And I believe that's exactly what the enemy wants us to feel. That Satan would love for us to believe that there's no one who really cares for God, no matter where it is you are, and that you're all by yourself. My family and I were going through some of the Harry Potter movies a couple weeks ago. I won't try and remember what movie it was and all those, but in one of the movies, Harry Potter was talking to his friend Luna, and he was expressing the feeling that he was all alone, and this is what she said to him. She says, if I were you-know-who, I'd want you to feel cut off from everyone else, because if it's just you alone, you're not as much of a threat. I think that's exactly true. I think the enemy wants us to feel alone. I think Satan wants us to genuinely believe that we are the only ones, whether if it's at school or home or the church, that we are all by ourselves in our convictions, in our faith and devotion to King Jesus. So then what do? The feelings come, the emotions are there. How do we defend against loneliness? What do we see from this chapter, from this scene with this prophet of God, that we can defend against these real feelings that we experience? And I think we need to start right here, that we need to consider the good. This seems counterintuitive to what we're going to talk about, but not every time that we are alone, not every lonely season or lonely moment is that a bad thing in our life. In fact, the times that we are by ourselves, removed and isolated from others and what's going on, can be an amazing opportunity for personal growth and healing. Because Elijah's here, and we don't know. We don't know why he was feeling what he was feeling. I mean, it might be that he just had a big moment on the mountain. And so physically and emotionally and mentally, he's drained. And he didn't take a chariot off the mountain to go back to Jezreel. He ran. In fact, he ran so fast, he outran a chariot. I don't know about you, but if I outran a chariot, I'm going to be tired. And when you're tired, you begin to feel tired in every another area, and mentally and emotionally and drained. Whatever it was, God knew he was tired, because when he arrives at the tree in Beersheba, and he lays down in verse 4 and tells the Lord, it's enough, I've given up, I'm done. In verse 5, he lays down and slept under a juniper tree. And behold, there was an angel touching him. And he said to him, arise, eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel in verse 7 of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. What does God do? He gives Elijah a moment and a season of rest. He gives him the time to recuperate and to heal. Even when he gets to the mountain of God, he doesn't come to him in the whirlwind and says, what is your problem, dude? Get out of the cave and go back. In the gentle voice, he calms and quiets his anxious spirit. There are times when we need to withdraw from everything, because even Jesus, the Son of God, chose some very strategic times and places to just get away from it all, the lonely places where he could completely focus on God. Now, here's the thing. Those moments in life, isolated, unplugged, quiet, those are rare moments. Think about that. When was the last time when you sat completely quiet? No texts, no phones, no MP3, no radio, no TV, no children, no spouse, no friends, just you. Sometimes that silence can be deafening, can't it? But those moments when it's just you, and just you by yourself, can be a moment when you have prayed like never before. When in the calmness of your thoughts, the undistractions in the moment, you can say to God perhaps things that you've not thought of before or felt before. You can really think about your life and who you are and where you are, undistracted by the noise that's trying to get your attention. You can meditate on why you're here and where you're going. You can use that to be a moment to heal from perhaps anxieties or fears or frustrations with the world, to be unbothered, to be able to process the thoughts that are wrestling in your mind. Because what you're going to find, if honestly you spend those moments alone and there's nothing distracting you, what you're going to find is what God did for Elijah and really what God did for Paul. Because when Paul was isolated and left alone and no one was there for him in verse 17, the Lord stood by me and strengthened me so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. So I was rescued from the lion's mouth. I was alone. No one stood with me. But what I realized was God is always with me. And so maybe may I encourage to you, if you've not found this yet, or if you're there, not to resist the quiet, still moments in your life, the lonely moments. They can be really good for you. And in fact, I think far more of us need to find those lonely places. We need to leave our devices in a place we can't find them and to go away to the mountains, wherever that would be. I know there's no mountains in Dallas. Get the image with me. Go somewhere alone. Get to a quiet place and be still. It's amazing in the stillness, with nothing pulling at your attention, how your mind can really focus back on God. See the good that can come from our lonely seasons. We need to confront the lies that enter into our minds, because two times in verse 10 and verse 14, Elijah says this, I am alone. Two times, I'm alone. No one else. There's no one who's faithful. There's no one who bows. There's no one else who's interested in being faithful to you. And what's amazing is that God lets him say it two times. God lets Elijah vent the frustrations of his heart. But after the second time, God addresses these lies, and he says in verse 17, it shall come about that the one who escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu, shall be put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha, shall be put to death. Yet I will leave, in verse 18, 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Elijah did not know these 7,000. In fact, he didn't even know about these 7,000. But God did. God did. Here's what God is saying to Elijah, and what we need to realize, what you feel is not always what is real. I feel like I'm alone. I feel like I'm the only one who's faithful. I feel like no one else cares. And God says, I know you feel that way, but let me tell you the reality. There's 7,000, Elijah, who's not bowed down to Baal. There's 7,000 who have the same faith and the same conviction as you do. Because it's in those moments, brethren, that Satan's going to attack the hardest, and his attack is going to be this, man, I'm all alone. No one knows what I'm going through. No one does, because no one really cares. No one asks me how I'm doing. No one's texted me. No one's called me. No one knows what it's like. No one cares. I'm all by myself. And yet the reality is, what it is that we feel is not what it is that is real. Not one of us enter into this world unconnected from another. It's true with our families. Every one of us has families, rich family heritage, in which we have moms and dads who love us and care for us, and siblings who treasure us, and we're there together as a family unit. But I think even this morning about what's so special about this day, Sunday, and how we are not just isolated members who come in for a service and leave and go our way unconnected, but we are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another, which is a way of saying this, you are special, you are important, you are respected, you are a contributor, and you belong. Keep your marker here in 1 Kings 19 and go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. I want you to read that with me. Keep your marker there, 1 Kings 19. Let's get over to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. First Corinthians chapter 12, Paul is writing about the body, the church, the saved of God. And he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 18, he says, but now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body just as he desired. If they were all one member, where would the body be? But now there are many members, but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Or again, the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, it's much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And even those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor. And on our less presentable members, we become much more presentable. Whereas our more presentable members have no need of it. But God has so composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, so that there be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are Christ's body, and you are individually members of it. Do you hear what he's saying there? You're different. We're different. We're different. So a lot of ways we define that and look at that and describe it. He talks about like a body, a physical body. There's eyes and ears and tongues and mouth and smiles, and that's what you notice. But I've not seen someone come up and say, you have a really nice gallbladder. I'm really impressed with that. I like that a lot. I love your toes. That's kind of creepy if someone says that. But they say, I like your smile. I like your hair. But you know, gallbladders are important. And toes. And fingers. And the way we talk about it might be something like this. I am more of a people person, or I'm not really a people person. We use words like, he's really extroverted, and I'm really introverted. He's a dog, and I'm a cat. He draws all the attention, and I just really couldn't care less. Pandemic, that was like my life. I was really good just being a hermit and living by myself. That describes us sometimes. In the service of God, it might sound like this. There's some people, and they do a lot of things that's really seen, public. They're up on the stage, or they're teaching a class, and we see how they are serving God. And then there's some we don't really see, but they're serving, and they're active, and they're important. Paul's point here is this. I know you're different. You're different in your talents and different in your abilities, but when you look back at verse 18, the differences we have are by God's design. That's how God made us. God made us special. He made you special. He made you you, and you will never be anyone but you. Don't try and be someone else other than you. Paul's point is simply this. The differences we have are not to be a cause of division, but actually of greater unity. Our differences are strength. Our differences remind each other that there's places in which we are strong and places in which we are weak. And when we pull those strengths and weaknesses together and pull together in love and in harmony, we are exactly what God wanted us to be, a fully functioning, active, serving body. That's what we are. So maybe you can't do what other people can do, but you're here and you are doing what God made you to do, to serve, to strengthen, to encourage, and to help. Satan wants you to believe, he wants us to believe, I'm all alone. No one else. No one else feels what I feel. No one else believes what I believe. No one else has the convictions that I do. And brethren, we need today to confront those lies, to shout back to Satan, we are one. We are members of one another. I think the best way to do it, I read it this week. And I'm going to share it with you. And this is what we need to say. This is our response to Satan, who says, you're all alone. No one knows what it's like. No one stands with you. This is our response to him. Satan, listen up. Listen now. Listen long and listen well. We are the church of the living God. We are bought with blood, charged with power, married to Jesus, indwelt with his spirit, immune from destruction and destined for victory. We will not fear your foolish foibles or run from your roaring. Fold under your fire. Be vulnerable to your vehemence. Be scattered by your schemes. Be derailed by your deceptions or lulled by your lies. Buckle under your barking. Acquiesce to your attacks or be scared by your subtlety. We are the company of the committed, the crowd of the covenant, the congregation of the courageous, the crew of the commissioned. We are the fellowship of the faithful, the battalion of believers, the regiment of the redeemed, the division of the devoted. We are the army of the approved, the team of the triumphant, the lot of the lords, the platoon of the powerful. We are the vestige of the victorious. We are not here to dread the war, to plan the war, to study the war, to evaluate the war, discuss the war. We came to win the war. Satan, the clock is running out for you. We await our deliverance, but your defeat. We await our reign, but your ruin, our victory, and your vindication. You can summon all your hosts, but you'll lose the battle. For he that is in us is greater than he that is in the world. We are the church of the living God, blood washed, spirit-filled, battle-scarred, unrelenting, and indestructible, and the gates of hell will not prevail against us. We are not alone. And so God came to his prophet. He gave him time to heal. He gave him gentle words to comfort his fear-stricken and anxious heart. But eventually Elijah had to exit that cave. He had to come out. He had to come out because there was a purpose God had for him. Back in 1 Kings chapter 19, God had a specific plan for Elijah and work that he needed to do. 1 Kings chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19. It says in verse 15, the Lord says to him, go and return your way and go to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael, king over Aram, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint as king over Israel. There were kings he was to appoint and to change and to uphold the political upheaval in Israel. And the end of verse 16, he says, Elijah, the son of Shaphat of Abel Meholah, you shall appoint as prophet in your place. He was to prepare and mentor the next prophet of God. In other words, God had a plan and a role for Elijah, and that plan was not staying in isolation. He had to get out of the cave and get back to work. Now, you got to come here for a minute. We're going to end right here. So I need you here. I need your attention for those of you streaming at home. There are seasons in which it may feel good. In fact, it may be important for us to get away. We talked about that, quiet moments, times in which we need to heal and collect our thoughts, but we cannot live in isolation. We cannot. By God's design, we were made to belong. The Lord said from the very beginning, he looked at what he made and he said, it is not good for man to be alone, which means everyone needs someone. We do. We need someone. And so while there may be moments in which we get away to collect our thoughts, to heal and to process what's going on in our lives, eventually we have to come out of the cave and we have to be with one another. So let me cover some myths. Let's go through some myths that I know circulate in our mind. Myth number one, screens are the same as people because they're not. They're not. Connecting through a screen is not the same as connecting flesh and blood in person with a brother or sister or a close friend. I so appreciate the language that Paul gave in the end of 1 Corinthians about our brethren from the first century, because he says that the tradition of the brethren was to greet one another with a holy kiss. We focus on the kiss. That's what we focus on. What we fail to realize is that what God is calling for here is to be affectionate with one another, to be warm and kind towards one another. If you go to Italy, it's going to be a kiss on the cheek. If you go to Korea, it's going to be hand on arm or bowing at the belly. If you're in America, it's going to be a handshake, a high five, a fist bump, or a hug. But that's the point. Screens can never substitute people. It can't. It may last for a moment, it may last for a time, but there is something real and something powerful about being together, flesh and blood, to feel, to look, and to listen. Because I have a lady in my office with me all the time. Her name is Alexa, and she always listens to me, and she always thinks I'm right. And she does whatever it is I ask. Sometimes second time I have to say it, but she does what I ask. And I can talk with Alexa, and she'll talk back with me, but it's just a plastic disc. Because when I'm really sad or down or scared, you know what I didn't need last night? I didn't think about Alexa, but I got a lot of texts from my family here, and that meant the most. A year ago Monday, my grandfather passed away. So he has been on the other side of eternity for a year now. In my office, I keep this picture, the four generations, my grandfather, my father, me, and Benjamin. And I keep a letter he wrote to me when I decided to preach. One of the first letters he wrote to me about that and about that journey. And so I have the picture, and I have his letter. And I don't know if it's real or not, but I can still, and you'll, if you've lost a loved one, you'll understand, I can smell the letter and smell him. And I know his scent. And so I can look at this and smell him and hear his voice, but I'll tell you, this is not the same of having him here in person. So if you really think that I'm getting connected because I have social media, I have friends I text, I have friends that like and share, there is no substitution. There's nothing that will replace being together and being in person. Myth number two. It's amazing, isn't it, that all those now thousands of years ago, Solomon was speaking right to our times when he said that a man of many companions may come to ruin, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. There's a difference between fans and friends. Social media likes, followers, friends are nothing but fans, and they're there for you when you give them what they like. But as soon as you don't give them what they like or something better comes along, they're gone. They are not real, they are imaginary. Because a real friend is not someone who likes what only they like. A real friend, as Solomon would say, is someone who is there at every time, especially when it gets hard, especially when it's tough. A real friend is someone who you can always call on and lean on and depend on. It's not about having how many followers or fans on social media. It is, do you have a brother or a sister? Do you have a real friend in your life that you could look face to face and pour out your deepest needs and cares and concerns and know that they are going to listen and be there for you and help you? It doesn't have to be someone of the same age. It's simply someone who took the time to listen, to care, and to respond. There comes a time when you have to exit your cave bravely and step into the life of someone else. And brethren, we need to listen to the warnings. Maybe the encouragement, say it that way, the encouragement of the Hebrew writer when he says that we need to be looking out. We need to be looking out among our family here and to realize that there may be some among us who are just weak, some who are struggling, some who are not where they used to be. And if we can be any part of helping them to heal and to grow, to get back to being strong and comfortable and vibrant again spiritually, that is our role. And that's what we need to be on watch for, my young people. And that's what you need to be on watch for. If you see someone who's over by themselves, isolated by themselves, and they don't really have a lot of people around them, that's your responsibility. That's my goal. That's my job today, is that I'm going to find a way to unfold them and bring them in. If I see someone and they're by themselves, that ought to be our mission that day, is to go to them to make sure that no one here feels isolated on an island and alone. In fact, maybe, brethren, it's time for us to take the role of God, who two times in this context, in verse 10 and verse 13, gently said, "Why are you here? Why are you in your cave, brother? Why are you hiding in this cave, sister? Isn't it time to come on out?" There's a student at Yale who, upon graduating, wrote a piece. And she entitled it, "The Opposite of Loneliness." She made the point that her time at Yale was essentially that she had friends, she had experiences, she had everything she needed, and not once did she find herself vexed with the emotions and feelings of being alone. And I love that. Because if there were ever a place, good brethren, if there were ever a description that could be said of the people of God, would it not be that we are the opposite of loneliness? We are not simply called to believe. We are called to belong. We belong to the Lord Jesus. But we belong together. We are members of one another. We weep when one another weeps. We rejoice when one another rejoices. But good brethren, this should be the place where loneliness dies. Let's call each other out of the caves. Let's take a step and be brave and leave our isolations. And let's keep on being that family, that strong, loving family that's connected, guarding against these serious dangers of feeling alone. You have listened so well today. One note for a high school class. All of you are going to be together for our Bible class. And so at the end of the hallway in the new wing, that's where a high school class is going to be. We're going to have a word of prayer and a final song, and be dismissed to our Bible classes. We encourage you to find the class today. Our men are in the back to help you find your way to class, but that's where we're going to go, continuing our morning with the Lord. Let's all stand and be led in that prayer and that final song.